Are we able to see the theosophical experience in terms of its expression in the myth? So I wrote somewhere else before that one can very easily and I think very profitably look at something like the story of Atlantis as a myth. That way it always remains meaningful. If indeed, we'll look at that a little later, if Atlantis is the metaphor for the sunken glory of our own spiritual splendor, which once long ago and far away, out of time and out of mind, reigned with great glory and did many wondrous things and then went down under the unconscious and may rise again, that is an eternally alive myth. The sunken civilization is a great archetype. But if we primarily concentrate on it as a belief in a historical event, so-called, which thus far no one could really ever scientifically prove. Maybe they will someday, but as Ed Abdil said when I was talking about this yesterday, and even if they prove it, so what? That's going to be just another fact. So we can jump around and write letters to the newspaper, hey, now 200 years after H.P. Blavatsky wrote about this, we found Atlantis, big deal. There's some people in Los Angeles who in the 1960s set out on this boat to find Atlantis. They went over to the coast of Spain, and that was still when the Caudillo Francisco Franco Bahamonde was there and things. So the government finally didn't like these California weirdos looking for Atlantis off the coast of Spain, so they chased them away. So they said, oh well, so they went over into the Irish Sea and were looking for it over there. It's a little bit like the old Jewish lady who was conducting a cooking class, and she was showing people, it's not a very vegetarian joke, but I'm sorry, I don't know too many of those, about how to make a stuffed chicken. And after she talked about it for about an hour or so and all the ingredients, said, and if you can't find the chicken, well, then take a fish. So that's it. If you can't do it in Spain, look in Ireland. So what? But the whole issue really being that you can see the difference. A fact is a fact is a fact. It doesn't go anywhere. It's happened already. That's why it's a fact. But the myth is still happening. The real myth is never finished. It's an unending source of individual, personal, transforming creativity. And that is why the myth is superior to fact. This is what the old Gnostics and the more orthodox kind of early Christians were arguing about, and eventually the orthodox won out. They always seem to the poor dears. And then when they win, they don't know what to do with their victory. The Orthodox Christians, so-called, insisted on the tremendous importance of the factuality of the death and resurrection of Jesus. And the other Gnostic-type folks said, well, that's all well and good. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't happen. Maybe it happened this way, maybe it happened in that way. But the important thing is its mythic significance, that this is something that can happen in us, that this is the exemplary mythic act of our own death and resurrection. And so they were arguing in this fashion, and that is always the nature of the argument. To the factual-minded, the fact is the important thing, but of course that remains again a sort of a cul-de-sac. But the myth is creative. Now, not to get stuck there either and get now a cul-de-sac out of the myth, to the myth then usually, I would say almost inevitably, is added at some point ritual. Now, ritual has a bad press in the eyes of some people. It's improved a little, but not all that much. And there is reason for that, because we we become accustomed to sort of rituals that have become purely habitual, and that are no longer really vitally connected with the myth that gave rise to them, ritualistic performances. When the ritual is vitally connected with the myth, then it is really its enactment. So that one learns of the myth, let's say, as in olden days, from the lore masters who come to the village and or maybe live there, and then usually accompanied by some musical instrument in a sing-songy, chanty way, sing the myth to the people. But then eventually the myth has to be acted out, has to be lived out in a more total dramatized form in order to truly become effective within consciousness. So the ritual stands to the myth in the kind of relationship as, let us say, a performance of Parsifal by Wagner stands to the libretto of the opera. You can read the libretto, and since Wagner was a pretty good writer, especially in the original Germans, very poetic and very powerful, and you can get a terrific idea of the story. But it's not the same as seeing it performed. And so the performance brings it down now to the level of the senses, from the feeling and thinking and intuitive function down into the sensate function. And that is why a good ritual enlists as many of the senses as possible, if possible, all of them. Which is, of course, one of the reasons to just mention something why a ritual without incense is not really complete, because the olfactory sense has to be in it too. That is why communion includes tasting the sacred substance, because that sense has to be involved, and so on and so forth. So now the process being that when the experience has come and been turned into myth, the myth has been expressed in ritual, sort of enough psychic energy has been gathered in the course of this process by the individual psyche, it geared itself up to catapult itself back again and come back to experience. So the alternative tradition, beginning with the shamans of old, has practiced this. Experience to myth, myth to ritual, back to experience again. That's a very different method and a very different situation from the way the mainstream, the great body of humanity, which is involved in society, which is involved in the slow movement and the slow growth of the great mass, operates. Although they have their particular myth too, as we said, only it works much more slowly, and this experiential return is much more at the unconscious level. Doesn't quite sink through into consciousness. The myth then is the form within which the direct experiential knowledge is expressed. Mircea Eliade, a very important person in this field, who incidentally, while born in Romania and having lived in many different countries, did really his great work right here at the University of Chicago, not far from here. Mircea Eliade has a classification which I think might serve as another good alternative to an amplifying material to the classifications that Joy has given us earlier on. Mircea Eliade said that the myth is a story that tells that which really happens to the knower. He also says that a myth is a story that has four characteristics. And here we to depart a little bit from turn John Algeo's definition of reincarnation a little bit around, because Iliade would probably say more that the myth is true without being factual. So it's not the untrue fact, but the other way around, but it really means the same thing. So he said, the myth is true, although not factually true. Second, it is sacred. That means it is not ordinary or mundane, but rather extraordinary and transmundane, we might say, out of this world. Then it is exemplary. It implies that the act or experience can or indeed must be replicated by us today. In other words, the myth, by way of its exemplary nature, I'll say a little more about it probably in a few minutes, automatically implies that this can be done, ought to be done, must be done by you. You can't just leave it there on the shelf and put it away. What does Jesus say in the Last Supper on Maundy Thursday? Go and do this in remembrance of me. You see, this is the act, the repetition of the divine act. And the old shamans and people like that always tell the story of what the gods did, and then the conclusion drawn from this is, as they have done then, so we must do now. This is the repetition of the divine act, the exemplary act. Now, that's not true of, that's not really true of belief and commandment, because with the commandment you are also told to do and more often not to do things. But the issue always is because God said so, you know, or somebody else, whoever it was who said it. You know, Lord Bertrand Russell, who was of course quite a wag and who was a great critic of ethical monotheism, used to say that the different religions have different emphases. He said that the, let's say for the Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so forth, are bee religions, not having to do with bees that buzz around, but having to do with being. That Judaism is a do religion, and that Christianity is a don't religion. It's everything, you know, don't do this, don't do that. You know? That's how a lot of that works. But that is a far cry, indeed. It's probably a malign caricature of the exemplary act of the myth. So that's the exemplary. And lastly, he says that the myth is significant, or it signalizes or signifies a meaning in terms of the human psyche. It's a smoke signal. It's a sign of meaning. Now, let's look at this maybe a little bit in greater detail. And here I'm going to be a little bit unfair because what I may refer to here a little bit is a particular myth which I'm not prepared to tell you now, because it would take up too much time. But a little bit later on, I want to, like I did yesterday, recount an example, as an example, a particular myth, but it will be a brief and very concentrated myth, which I think would be much more helpful to us. So now, the myth that I'm referring to right now is the myth of Sophia, that some of you are familiar with. And as I say, if you would like to be informed about it, there is a recently published Quest book on the reemergence of the goddess, in which there is sort of the second essay, I think, the second or third essay in it is, there is a description of the myth of Sophia. And the man who wrote it knew quite a bit about it, because it was myself. So, you know, you could find it there now, and there will be a much more extensive description, more poetic description of it too, in in the Jung and the Lost Gospels in my forthcoming book. So anyway, that is the story of Lady Wisdom, a very important Gnostic myth. One of the relatively few great myths where a myth of the hero, where the hero is feminine. And now, for instance, when I look at these four characteristics and I conjure up in my mind the myth of Sophia, there is no doubt in my mind that in the sense that Eliade meant that this myth, for instance, is true. Let me give you a little proof of it. Over the last few years, especially last couple of years now, since I've been really getting around the country, lecturing, and before that in other countries, practically everywhere I go, there are at least one or two people who usually in a very shy and reticent manner at some point seek me out and tell me that they had an experience with Sophia. Happened here too. I won't tell you who it is, because it's a personal matter. But for instance, the story that I heard here just as the rain started coming down from someone, this individual didn't even know the name of Sophia, didn't know anything about the story, but was beginning to have experiences with this sort of feminine inner figure, inner teacher. Then he was beginning to get in his active imaginative experiences some names, and they led him through the world of the name of Selene, which is the moon goddess, to Helen, to Sophia, which is precisely the progression among the Gnostics. And the man didn't know anything about that, or the person didn't know anything about that. And things like this occur everywhere. Now, this is the kind of true nature of the myth. It doesn't mean factually that somewhere in history we are going to discover that there was a lady named Sophia. Well, there were many of them, but there was not the same one. But it means that the character of the myth, sometimes right down to the archetypally charged names, the sacred names, spontaneously arises from within the psyches of individuals in various ages. Now that is true. But we have all kinds of notions of truth. You know, we have a lot of that kind of 19th century naive notion of truth, which is, you know, the truth, not only with a capital T, but probably spelled in all capital letters. Somewhere out there, suspended in space, hangs truth. and if we just somehow get up there and grab it, then we've got it. We've got truth. See, the truth. Not just a truth, but the truth. And of course, to demonstrate this, I really need a prop that I don't have, but actually a prop that later on I might need, like a cup or a glass of water or something. But let's imagine this is the glass. The late Professor Ernest Wood, our dear and great theosophical friend, used to tell this story, that a little kid was in Sunday school and they were teaching the omnipresence of God. And so the kid said, so is God everywhere? And teacher said, yes. And so he said, is he in this class? Teacher said, well, yes. The kid put his hand and said, I've got him, I've got him. Now, you know, that is really the way our mind works. We want to get him or get it or get truth. But I think far more viable way of looking at the situation is that truth is something that we have to make. Now, I don't mean make up, but make alchemically. It grows out of the travails, the agonies, the choices, the failure, the frequent failures and the infrequent victories of our lives. And then it is truth. And it is our truth. really ours, not Blavatsky's truth, not even Jesus' truth, not even Mohammed's truth, ours. Which doesn't mean that these the formulations of truth given to us by these people cannot be of great assistance to us. But ultimately, we have to alchemically make that truth like a philosopher's stone ourselves. With that, it is with that kind of personal truth. And again, this is here is again something where we need to loosen up our thinking in terms of our attachment to concepts. Now, I wasn't around our dear feminist folk earlier on. I wasn't even here when I heard reports about it. However, of some of the commotion about the sexist language in theosophy and all of that. I'm glad I wasn't around because this way I didn't have to take sides. You know, it's because after all, that's something that I never do. I always avoid, don't I? But Joy knows something about that, I'm afraid. Well, in any event, if we are talking about language and the occasionally limiting influences of language, there are many other areas also where we need to not necessarily throw the language away, but begin to recognize the limitations. Such as, for instance, we almost automatically tend to associate the word personal with something lowly and not particularly spiritual. It's the impersonal life, this, that, and the other thing. And all that terminology has a validity within a certain context. But when it becomes a buzzword, then we look upon such concepts and the realities behind the concepts as personal, ego, self, as inevitably lowly and unpleasant. Then we are beginning to limit ourselves very greatly, because personal in the sense that it arises out of the alchemical laboratory of our own personhood is a tremendously important thing. This needs to be taken into account. And that is why the personal truth in that sense is very important. And as I think, it because we make it, but we don't necessarily make it up. There is a difference. So that reminds me of something that happened to me a few months ago. I was speaking somewhere and after lecture, a lady from the front row comes up to me very, very solemnly and very seriously, and she says, "Oh, thank you for channeling that information." I debated for a few minutes as to what I should say, and finally my trickster archetype got hold of me, as it so frequently does, because I don't resist it very strenuously anyway, and I said, "Oh no," I said, "you know, I don't channel this stuff, I just make it up." the expression on her face, you wouldn't believe, you wouldn't believe. That has to do with making up things, you know. However, let's get through this particular part anyway. The second characteristic Eliade mentions is it is sacred. Now, this means really it is set apart from mundane material. It concerns the divine world as against the profane world. It is special. It is holy. It is awesome. One clue, a linguistic clue that probably doesn't occur to us very often is when we say something is extraordinary, outside of the ordinary, what do we mean? Where does the word ordinary come from? I always associate it with a vin ordinaire in France. You know, it's the usual wine that you drink as against the non-usual one. But then this kind of bibulous analogy might not be appropriate for everyone. But ordinary literally means derived from order, according to the system. Now, the system, cosmos, order, is the mundane systematization of reality within which we live. The extraordinary is that which is outside of the system. Have you seen those beautiful Tibetan tankas that depict the great wheel, the wheel of time, the wheel of rebirth? And you see all the different beings, people and hungry ghosts and titans and all sorts of critters riding around like crazy in this wheel, you know, back and forth, back and forth. Then outside of the wheel, and the wheel is held by a great big demon, great Mahakala, the great time who makes this turn. We used to have a German shepherd dog at the College of Oriental Studies whom we called Mahakala, because he would come, and when people went into the Zendo, into the temple, they had to take their shoes off, and Mahakala came around and inevitably stole one shoe from every person. And you come out and you have one shoe, you know. And we have to go around the back of the building where Mahakala was playing with this mountain of shoes. And then we had to extract it from her. Well, I don't know whether the real Mahakala steals shoes, but it keeps making the great wheel go around. But off the wheel, there sit on their lotus thrones beautiful triumphant Buddhas who are looking down at this whole thing. Well, they are there in the extraordinary world. They are not in the ordo, in the system. They have gotten off the wheel. That is the whole meaning, really, of the Lord Buddha's enlightenment, of the chakra. So it is this extraordinary outside of the order of our worldly lives. Not within the orderly system of society, of house and home and business and worldly community. It is not shackled to earthly purposes and concerns. It is not shackled to intellectual and conceptual purposes and concerns. It is not dependent on anything else. And that is where people make a mistake, for instance, when they want to impose... This comes to my mind because of conversation over breakfast. Let's say upon sacred rites and scriptures and things of that sort, a primarily intellectually constructed notion of meaning. Say, you know, you can't say it that way because it rationally does not mean what I want it to mean. You can't play with myths like that. They have a life and a validity of their own. And when you shackle them to intellectual purposes, you are beginning to take away from their validity, from their energy. You have to be very careful with that. To some extent it can be done, but you have to be very intuitive. So here we are dealing with the sacred. It has to be approached with reverence, with awe, an attitude of specialness. It is set apart. Now, there comes the myth is exemplary. We mentioned that before. What goes on in the story has to do with something that we can replicate. It is a great example for us. Not necessarily physically, like, I don't know, the penitentes tie a cross to their backs on Good Friday and have themselves whipped and that sort. Well, you know, back in Hollywood we call that sacred S&M. But And I don't need to explain to you that has to do with the Marquis de Sade and the Baron von Sacher-Masoch, a kind of suffering nobility. But it is worthy of repetition and replication within the psychological makeup of the individual. And we mentioned that before. Then comes the myth. Lastly, the myth is significant. It signifies a psycho-spiritual meaning to the individual. Psychologically, we might say it has archetypal significance. As I contemplate and attempt to replicate the story of the myth, or as it is happening, its replication is taking place within myself, archetypal realities corresponding to the myth are activated. The psychic meaning arises in my consciousness by way of this significance of the story. So the significance is a sign of meaning. It's a flag that is being waved. It's a little bit similar, although its mechanism comes sort of from the opposite end of the process, to the synchronicity. The synchronicity, says Jung, is a sign, a signal, which arises in the outer world of the senses primarily when an archetype is activated in the psyche. So that kind of like the great beings from within us are rising to consciousness like a Loch Ness monster, a Leviathan coming out of the water. And you know, of course, that there is a dragon like that in Lake Geneva. We named him this morning Jenny, as against Nessie of the Loch Ness Monster. So it's that, it's there, you know, just got to look. But it's that sort of thing. When from the depths an archetypal being rises, it appears to be correlated, coordinated in terms of the chronology, the time, with certain signs in the world of the senses that call attention to that. As if a bird is flying overhead, or a beetle is crawling up on your arm, or something is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also, and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded, because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is someone is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the with the myth being significant, but within the myth also, and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded, because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also, and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also, and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is or sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also, and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also, and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also, and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to um, to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is the or sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is or sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is or sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded, because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded, because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also and in the whole process that the myth involves, they are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded, because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become more, move ahead, advance more in your own transformation. Now, just one other element I would like to clarify before maybe you wish to stretch your legs and I might hunt for a little water or something of that sort. And that is sometimes is telling you, hey, look, something important is happening. And that's the synchronicity. Here it is rather done in a certain different, certainly different way with the myth being significant, but within the myth also, and in the whole process that the myth involves, there are signs that call attention to the archetype within the myth, the archetypal meaning, so that the myth itself is a sign. And certainly synchronistic elements cannot be excluded, because it's very possible that you come in contact with a myth and you begin to pay attention to it at the very time in your life when that myth can do you the most good. So that if you are particularly attracted to Parsifal or whatever mythic figure and their story, that undoubtedly the chances are that there is something there for you. You are now in a position to use that exemplary myth and to replicate it within yourself and thereby become. And that, I think, is unfortunate, because these ideas, as really so many of the other of insights of Jung, I think have a tremendous value for the general culture. So along with someone whom I mentioned earlier because of this, Mircea Eliade, who was not really part of the Jungian circle, but who still, I think, adopted a lot of Jungian ideas, particularly the one of archetypes. Campbell stands as the true seminal figure of openly available, comprehensible research into the spirit of mythology and religion. In this respect, does that come in somewhere else? But I'll mention it here. It's precisely this avoidance of the pitfalls of the specialist that makes, I think, Campbell so valuable. In that respect, it occurred to me that Zimmer, who was, of course, one of Campbell's revered teachers, somewhere, I think, in The King of the Corpse, makes a wonderful statement about the kind of scholarship that he valued, and he said that the most valuable figure is the true dilettante. And Zimmer analyzed the word dilettante as coming from the Italian dilettante, namely someone who delights in what he is doing. He's doing it because of delight. Not because of the money he's going to make, not because of the tenure that he's going to get as in his professorship, not because of the other government grant that he or she is going to get, but because of the sense of delight. No secondary dependence. And in that sense, I would also like to say once again that I think that should be really, in many ways, the best definition of the real theosophist. After all, why are we in this peculiar business? I think that some level, at least, because it's delightful. It brings us delight. It has brought us delight. I can't speak for anyone else, but with my profound and justified sense of my own uniqueness, I'm still bound to admit that some of the things that happen to me also happen to others. You know? And so I am sure that I'm not alone in this, even if it jeopardizes my uniqueness. And I think that the theosophical that theosophical hole on the black vault of this world, through which a certain light began to shine upon me early in my life, has been from the very beginning till now, and I'm quite convinced by now till the end of my days, has been a source of constant delight to me. And that is what keeps us going in it. And it is certainly a similar delight that Blavatsky and others have felt. And I think that we should admit to ourselves that this is not an unworthy feeling. To have fun with what you are dedicated to is an adequate justification for your dedication. Don't worry so much about everything else. That doesn't mean that you are not serving humanity, of course you are, but you might also serve it helping Mother Teresa, or God forbid, even helping George Bush. there are various ways of helping humanity. I think that this is also a statement that we should advance when these controversies arise, like there was some time ago in the American Theosophist. What are we doing for, why aren't we more involved in social action, this, that, and the thing? Okay, if we can, but we are doing what we are doing, we are what we are because we enjoy it and because it's delightful, it is really delightful. And that delight is the delight of heaven. It's the ambrosia that comes from another world, and it does not really require an intellectual or physical justification beyond itself. That doesn't mean that we are purely hedonistic in our spirituality. But I think it's an important element. And so this is the kind of approach that Campbell brought to mythology. It is a delightful, it is exciting, it is any follow your own bliss. Which some people, especially of kind of our more, Calvinistic theosophists, I don't mean that they believe in Johnny Calvin, but they still follow some of that kind of puritanical outlook. I said, that's an immoral statement. That's not a good statement to follow your own bliss. Well, you have to understand what bliss is meant. It's not just coarse kind of silly enjoyment. Bliss, after all, is a very, very high quality in the Eastern systems, Satchit Ananda. You don't accuse that of anything. So that is really what has a great deal to do with following your own bliss. Secondly, I feel closer to Campbell perhaps than anyone else because of what I regard his extremely vital and necessary regard for art and the artist as the prophetic agencies, expressing the metaphors of the myths of eternity and of the future. Our time is short, so I will not do what I have done before to read to you from the inner reaches of outer space the passage that Campbell devotes to the artist. But let me just have to take my word for it to read the book. But we have the recognition on the part of Campbell, therefore, also of an aesthetic dimension of mythic reality. And this is extremely important. Campbell incidentally said that religion is a misunderstood myth. At some point. It's kind of one of those slight overstatements, maybe, whereby one gains the attention of the perpetually somnolent public. You kind of have to treat the public often like one treats a jackass. You have to hit them over the head with a 2x4 just to get their attention. that HPB certainly did enough of it, God bless her. So overstatements are sometimes in order. But of course there is much to it. What he really meant was probably precisely what Joy indicated, that here we are in the myth and we slide back into these things, and then the religion becomes really a misunderstood myth. We might say that aesthetic metaphor is a very important element and Campbell didn't call everything art, by the way. He recognized that there are such things that as an improper art or an improper use of art. He was certainly not a follower of clichés. And he didn't fall in, even though he moved a lot in the New Age circles, he certainly didn't fall in with any of the New Age clichés trying your sandal laces is considered art. That wasn't his, but he said that in the same manner, let us say, the improper art is a misunderstanding of art. But he felt that the artist must be, the true artist must be recognized in many ways as the shaman prophet of the myth and of the new myth. And since our great myths have deteriorated a great deal, they are not working in our own culture. So we have to look to that growing edge, where perhaps along with the occultist and the mystic, the Gnostic, the artist dwells, for the prophetic insight for the forthcoming of the images that will go into the myth, because the image is an extremely important element of the myth. So it's not so much from the prosaic area of the writer and the teacher of theory, but from the artist that we need to expect that. And that is a very important insight which we don't hear very often. Oh, yes, that was his Bible. Yes. 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 And it's really, it's not an easy thing to deal with. It really takes persistence. I would think it takes every bit as persistence as the secret doctrine. It's, yeah, but he certainly did. And so this, I think, is also that even we in our discipline need to take heed. I've heard some talk over the ages about it, but I think there is at some really deeply creative and non-artificial level, there is still somehow a great need for us to establish a liaison between theosophy and the artist. Just how it's to be done, I can't tell you, but the need for it, I think, is very, very great. Thirdly, I would acknowledge at least my extreme closeness to Campbell because of his what I would call thoroughly Gnostic dislike an iconoclastic treatment of the Judeo-Christian Islamic God. Namely, behind all of the jokes and things like that, Campbell, I think, was motivated by a very, very valid vision, namely that the God image of ethical monotheism is not no longer really helpful and viable in our culture. And I have to tell you this, whether it takes time away for something else or not, because these are wonderful stories, and it'll be good for the tape. You see, this is the thing now. When we had people who read books, they were bookworms. Well, now we have tapes, and we have, okay. I can't resist these things. In any event, it'll be good for them. Campbell, which is called the tapeworm. Ivy. Well, once again, my uniqueness goes away. But so Campbell, a famous story of Campbell's encounter with Martin Buber. Martin Buber, who was of course a great Jewish philosopher, and even though he was considered an existentialist, he was, you know, still very orthodox, and he even looked like Jehovah, if you know what Jehovah looked like, you know, big bristling beard and long hair and kind of you know, stout and strong and all of that. I should talk, but so he was there, and in this particular lecture, he mentioned the name God quite frequently. So he was finished. Campbell got up in the back of the room, was listening, and said, "Dr. Buber, I'd like to ask you a question. This God that you keep referring to, could you tell us what God you are talking about?" Buber rose like a wrathful god from the desert with lightning flashes from his eyes, and he was really ready to lower the boom on Campbell. And then apparently he began to recognize, oh, this is going to make me look good. This guy is baiting me. So he sort of simmered down, and then he shook his great mane and he said, "Well, if you don't know what God I'm referring to, all I can say is everyone has to come out of his own exile in his own way." And then he turned to the blackboard. You know? But the other one is even more dramatic, and I heard Campbell tell this one. Campbell was in New York, where of course he had an apartment and where he was a lot. And then was some evening he was coming out, as he said it, from his club, and he wore a tuxedo and a raincoat, and he was waiting for some transportation to get on his way. As he was waiting in the evening dusk, a Moonie came up to him, a little young follower of the Reverend Sun Yong Moon. And the Moonie came up to Campbell and said, "Mister, do you believe in God?" You know, kind of an opening. Campbell looked at him and said, "Young man, I believe in many gods. Oh, I believe in many, many gods." The kid was dumbfounded and struck down. And so he said, "But mister, about the God, you know, the God of the Bible and the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Father of Jesus and all of that." Campbell said, "Oh, that one," he said, "that God. Oh, yes, I believe in him too." And then he proceeded to give the young man a real lesson in mythology, gods and goddesses and everything. The kid really listened too. And then the taxi or whatever it was came, and Campbell waved goodbye, and the young man stood there on the sidewalk and said, "Oh, thanks, mister, thanks. That was really interesting." A very unusual response that he got out of Campbell. Let's say this removal, this loosening of the God image, and the whole complex that this rigid monotheism has really created in Western culture, because it has its implications along all kinds of lines. Our one-sidedness, our single-mindedness, our way of looking at only one truth, only one idea, only one form of behavior, everything else is no good. This really all comes from our God image of the monotheistic God. And you know who was the first one? Well, the first one at least I know of who vociferously, wildly, furiously knocked the Jehovah image, H.P. Blavatsky, you know? I mean, I see some pretty nasty things about old Jehovah, but by gum, I hardly ever come close to H.P.V. You know, she really knew how to give it to him. Now we need to get through with this very quickly. Campbell also, I think, had in spite of his vast learning in Eastern mythology and art and religion, Campbell, like a true individual who took his light from the flame of C.G. Jung, was very much convinced of the fact that the West, that Western traditions, Western mythologies had a particular keynote, and that we ought not to take upon ourselves like a garment and immerse ourselves rather unconsciously into the framework of the East, whatever that may be. And he particularly pointed to the arising and the psycho-spiritual utility of the development of personhood in the West as a terribly important factor. And one area where he did a wonderful job of that, you should look it up if you can, was in his references to the troubadour phenomenon. Some of that you will find in his book Myths to Live By, where there is a chapter, The Myth of Love. He gives a wonderful synopsis there of that, and he points out that that was really the great turning point where the love phenomenon as an ennobling and transformative agent, as the love of a person. So it's the turning of Eros into an ennobling and spiritualizing influence, but the love object, which is itself a screwy, bad term, you know, is a person. And that this should by no means be confused with, let us say, the tantric sex magic and things of that sort. Not that they don't have a validity of their own, because out of the tantric things and so forth, personhood is missing. And if I may say so with all due respect in this case to the ladies who sometimes prefer to be women, but then some of them don't mind being ladies either, be careful when you cultivate this image of the goddess for yourself. And as a kind of an impersonal force, whether it's in a love relationship or anywhere else. Because by so doing, there could be a loss of something very, very important, and that is personhood. Something that the troubadour sort of wrested from the dragon of the unconscious and brought to us. You have to be very careful. Gods are very important, but we've got to be humans. We have been called to be human persons. Then we can do business with the gods and the goddesses, and they'll respect us. And we'll needless to say, they demand respect from us. That's their business. But to be taken over by them is not all that important. And so we have to be very careful that the depersonalization does not occur, and in these areas, and Campbell was wonderful, had a wonderful sense of pointing that out. there are other issues. I think I will only mention the one now, because really the time has gone. And that you might also look into in some of his speeches and in a portion of the inner reaches of outer space. Campbell, unlike so many others in the New Age, or really in many other ages, had a wonderful affinity for the archetypal underpinnings and true character of what I like to call Hermetic America. Campbell appreciated the myth and the symbols that underlie the foundation in the early history of the American Republic. And you might say that Campbell was one of the very few true spiritual patriots of America whom I have met. And I respected that very greatly, because I feel that we can lose a lot when we do not understand the kind of archetypal keynote of the nation within which we live. An archetypal keynote which no doubt has been glossed over, corrupted, trampled into the ground, but which is really there. And this is much more important than arguing whether a piece of cloth can be burned or not. There is a true patriotism. It's a spiritual patriotism. It's a conscious patriotism. It's a patriotism that is rooted in the myth that underlies this country. And Campbell knew it, and he wasn't afraid to say it. He wasn't afraid to say anything, for that matter. Here was a man who was practically adored by much of the New Age, but he mercilessly blasted the unconscious clichés and shibboleths of all kinds. He spoke his mind exactly. He wasn't afraid that his books are not going to sell or that people won't come to his lectures. He was really himself, and he said it as he saw it. And he has become, and I hope he will continue to remain, a really prophetic figure. Now, time is almost up, but a myth of some magnitude and some importance. Perhaps, unlike I have done yesterday, I will not read so much of it, but try to summarize at least some of it in my own words to give you the idea, which is what I have done in the forthcoming book also. I wrote my own version of the Hymn of the Pearl, although accurate to the originals. The Hymn of the Pearl is a very beautiful, simple monomyth. It comes from a scripture, an apocryphal scripture that is called the Acts of Thomas, not to be confused with the Gospel of Thomas and things like that. This particular scripture has been available for quite a long time. And it's integrated within a larger scripture, the rest of it is not so interesting, that is all attributed to Thomas the Apostle, who, you know, according to tradition, went to India. And is supposed to have been martyred, actually not very far from Madras, and supposed to be buried there. And now, when St. Thomas was thrown into prison, according to this story in India, he walked into the dungeon, and there were all these poor characters who have been confined there, probably for various reasons, and they saw the Christian holy man from far away to come there. And they all ran up to him and implored him, "Please, sir, tell us a story. Tell us a beautiful story to forget about our troubles." And then he told the story of the person, the being. It's a good one in that sense because it doesn't really have any gender identity as such. It could be man or woman, who comes from the heavens down into the world in order to find, in metaphorically stated, symbolically stated, the land of Egypt, a pearl which is in the sea and is guarded by a great, terrible, roaring serpent. This individual is a child of the highest heavens. The parents are described as the king, the universal king, the king of heaven, and the mother as the empress of the east. And so the parents call the child in and say, "Our child, go down into the land of Egypt and bring us back the pearl. And then you can come back to heaven, and with your brother who remains here with us, you will be the co-ruler, the heir to our kingdom." And the young person goes forth and descends through the various regions of the heavens, the various aeons, comes to the gate, so to say, where the guardians remove his beautiful royal robe. And that's why G.R.S. Mead, the great and wonderful translator of Gnostic materials, called this, unlike many of the other translators, the hymn or the song of the robe of glory, rather than of the pearl, because the two key elements in it really are the pearl and the robe. Now you can look at it either way. So there he comes down into the world without his robe, arrives in Egypt and goes straight to the area where the serpent guarding the pearl is located, and there is an inn. He comes to this wayside inn and settles in there, puts on what he calls the unpalatable and filthy garments that he finds there, obviously our body, and settles in and There he finds among others also another young person who he can't talk really to the local people, the Egyptians at all, but he says, who was of my race and who was also an offspring of kings. And so there was an affinity and he could talk with this one. And this one implores him, watch out, be very careful with the local people because they are intent on putting you to sleep so that you will forget your mission. But he didn't quite understand what that meant, I suppose. And so he sat down with the Egyptians and ate and drank of their food and their drink. And promptly he fell into a deep sleep. And this was the sleep of forgetfulness, like the waters of Leyte and so forth, which are lethal. That's where it comes from. And he forgot everything. He forgot who he was. He forgot that he was the child of the heavenly king and queen. He forgot his mission, and he was in a state of amnesia, of forgetfulness. But fortunately, his parents from above were watching. They knew what was taking place. And so they sent him a letter upon which all the great ones of the heavenly kingdom, all the Aeonial rulers imprinted their signature and their seal. And the letter, again, is a very mystical object because while it is written, it also has a voice, it also flies on the like the wings of an eagle. And here is, this one at least I'll read to you, here is the letter. From thy father, the king of kings, and from thy mother, the mistress of the east, and from thy brother, our viceroy, unto thee, our son in Egypt, greeting. Awake and rise up out of thy sleep, and perceive the words of our letter. Remember that thou art a king's child. Behold whom thou hast served in bondage. Be mindful of the pearl for whose sake thou hast departed into Egypt. Remember thy robe of glory, recall thy splendid mantle, that thou mayest put them on and deck thyself with them, and thy name be read in the book of the heroes, and thou become with thy brother our deputy, heir in our kingdom. And so he awakens. Now he is restored to his own consciousness. He promptly proceeds to the sea where the roaring serpent guards the pearl. And now here is an interesting little twist. He is not St. George the Dragon Slayer, or he is not part of that military mythos, because he doesn't take out a sword and hack off the head of the serpent, but he chants the name of his parents. He sings a magic formula over the serpent, and the serpent goes to sleep. And gently and nicely he can take the pearl. So he has conquered by divine magic. Then he takes the pearl and ascends through the heavenly regions, again comes to the various places, come to the portals where the treasurers of heaven await him of the east. And from thy brother, our viceroy, unto thee, our son in Egypt, greeting. Awake and rise up out of thy sleep, and perceive the words of our letter. Remember that thou art a king's child. Behold whom thou hast served in bondage. Be mindful of the pearl for whose sake thou hast departed into Egypt. Remember thy robe of glory, recall thy splendid mantle, that thou mayest put them on and deck thyself with them, and thy name be read in the book of the heroes, and thou become with thy brother our deputy, heir in our kingdom. And so he awakens. Now he is restored to his own consciousness. He promptly proceeds to the sea where the roaring serpent guards the pearl. And now here is an interesting little twist. He is not St. George the Dragon Slayer, or he is not part of that military mythos, because he doesn't take out a sword and hack off the head of the serpent, but he chants the name of his parents. He sings a magic formula over the serpent, and the serpent goes to sleep. And gently and nicely he can take the pearl. So he has conquered by divine magic. Then he takes the pearl and ascends through the heavenly regions, again comes to the various places, come to the portals where the treasurers of heaven await him of the east. And from thy brother, our viceroy, unto thee, our son in Egypt, greeting. Awake and rise up out of thy sleep, and perceive the words of our letter. Remember that thou art a king's child. Behold whom thou hast served in bondage. Be mindful of the pearl for whose sake thou hast departed into Egypt. Remember thy robe of glory, recall thy splendid mantle, that thou mayest put them on and deck thyself with them, and thy name be read in the book of the heroes, and thou become with thy brother our deputy, heir in our kingdom. And so he awakens. Now he is restored to his own consciousness. He promptly proceeds to the sea, where the roaring serpent guards the pearl. And now here is an interesting little twist. He is not St. George the Dragon Slayer, or he is not part of that military mythos, because he doesn't take out a sword and hack off the head of the serpent, but he chants the name of his parents. He sings a magic formula over the serpent, and the serpent goes to sleep. And gently and nicely he can take the pearl. So he has conquered by divine magic. Then he takes the pearl and ascends through the heavenly regions, again comes to the various places, come to the portals where the treasurers of heaven await him of the east. And from thy brother, our viceroy, unto thee, our son in Egypt, greeting. Awake and rise up out of thy sleep, and perceive the words of our letter. Remember that thou art a king's child. Behold whom thou hast served in bondage. Be mindful of the pearl for whose sake thou hast departed into Egypt. Remember thy robe of glory, recall thy splendid mantle, that thou mayest put them on and deck thyself with them, and thy name be read in the book of the heroes, and thou become with thy brother our deputy, heir in our kingdom. And so he awakens. Now he is restored to his own consciousness. He promptly proceeds to the sea, where the roaring serpent guards the pearl. And now here is an interesting little twist. He is not St. George the Dragon Slayer, or he is not part of that military mythos, because he doesn't take out a sword and hack off the head of the serpent, but he chants the name of his parents. He sings a magic formula over the serpent, and the serpent goes to sleep. And gently and nicely he can take the pearl. So he has conquered by divine magic. Then he takes the pearl and ascends through the heavenly regions, again comes to the various places, come to the portals where the treasurers of heaven await him of the east. And from thy brother, our viceroy, unto thee, our son in Egypt, greeting. Awake and rise up out of thy sleep, and perceive the words of our letter. Remember that thou art a king's child. Behold whom thou hast served in bondage. Be mindful of the pearl for whose sake thou hast departed into Egypt. Remember thy robe of glory, recall thy splendid mantle, that thou mayest put them on and deck thyself with them, and thy name be read in the book of the heroes, and thou become with thy brother our deputy, heir in our kingdom. And so he awakens. Now he is restored to his own consciousness. He promptly proceeds to the sea, where the roaring serpent guards the pearl. And now here is an interesting little twist. He is not a St. George the Dragon Slayer, or he is not part of that military mythos, because he doesn't take out a sword and hack off the head of the serpent, but he chants the name of his parents. He sings a magic formula over the serpent, and the serpent goes to sleep. And gently and nicely he can take the pearl. So he has conquered by divine magic. Then he takes the pearl and ascends through the heavenly regions, again comes to the various places, come to the portals where the treasurers of heaven await him of the east. And from thy brother, our viceroy, unto thee, our son in Egypt, greeting. Awake and rise up out of thy sleep, and perceive the words of our letter. Remember that thou art a king's child. Behold whom thou hast served in bondage. Be mindful of the pearl for whose sake thou hast departed into Egypt. Remember thy robe of glory, recall thy splendid mantle, that thou mayest put them on and deck thyself with them, and thy name be read in the book of the heroes, and thou become with thy brother our deputy, heir in our kingdom. And so he awakens. Now he is restored to his own consciousness. He promptly proceeds to the sea, where the roaring serpent guards the pearl. And now here is an interesting little twist. He is not a St. George the Dragon Slayer, or he is not part of that military mythos, because he doesn't take out a sword and hack off the head of the serpent, but he chants the name of his parents. He sings a magic formula over the serpent, and the serpent goes to sleep. And gently and nicely he can take the pearl. So he has conquered by divine magic. Then he takes the pearl and ascends through the heavenly regions, again comes to the various places, come to the portals where the treasurers of heaven await him of the east. And from thy brother, our viceroy, unto thee, our son in Egypt, greeting. Awake and rise up out of thy sleep, and perceive the words of our letter. Remember that thou art a king's child. Behold whom thou hast served in bondage. Be mindful of the pearl for whose sake thou hast departed into Egypt. Remember thy robe of glory, recall thy splendid mantle, that thou mayest put them on and deck thyself with them, and thy name be read in the book of the heroes, and thou become with thy brother our deputy, heir in our kingdom. And so he awakens. Now he is restored to his own consciousness. He promptly proceeds to the sea, where the roaring serpent guards the pearl. And now here is an interesting little twist. He is not a St. George the Dragon Slayer, or he is not part of that military mythos, because he doesn't take out a sword and hack off the head of the serpent, but he chants the name of his parents. He sings a magic formula over the serpent, and the serpent goes to sleep. And gently and nicely he can take the pearl. So he has conquered by divine magic. Then he takes the pearl and ascends through the heavenly region.